This is Reaching Out by Henri Nouwen, Chapter 1, and it's called A Suffocating Loneliness. He suggests that for all of us it's far from easy to enter into the painful experience of loneliness. We want to stay away from it, and yet it is an experience that enters into everyone's life at some point. We've all experienced it, whether it be at school or at work or moving to a new town. It's common to the human condition. But contemporary Western society has heightened the awareness of our loneliness to an unusual degree. Nouwen describes a visit to New York City, and he wrote the following. He said, "Sitting in the subway, I'm surrounded by silent people, hidden behind their newspapers or staring away in a world of their own fantasies. Nobody speaks with a stranger, and a patrolling policeman keeps reminding me that people are not necessarily out to help each other. But when my eyes wander over the walls of the train covered with invitations to buy more or new products, I see young, beautiful people enjoying each other in a gentle embrace, playful men and women smiling at each other in fast sailboats, proud explorers on horseback encouraging each other to take brave risks, fearless children dancing on a sunny beach, and charming girls always ready to serve me in airplanes and ocean liners. While the subway train runs from one dark tunnel to another, and I am nervously aware where I keep my money, the words and images decorating my fearful world speak about love, gentleness, tenderness, and about joyful togetherness. The contemporary society in which we find ourselves makes us acutely aware of our loneliness. We become increasingly aware that we are living in a world where even the most intimate relationships have become part of competition and rivalry." He suggests that loneliness is one of the most universal sources of human suffering. Psychiatrists and clinical psychologists speak about it as the most frequently expressed complaint and the root not only of increasing numbers of suicides, but also of alcoholism, drug use, and different psychosomatic symptoms, such as headaches, stomach and lower back pains, and of a large number of traffic accidents. Children, adolescents, adults and old people are in growing degree exposed to the contagious disease of loneliness in a world in which competitive individualism tries to reconcile itself with a culture that speaks about togetherness, unity and the community as the ideals to which we strive for. Why is it that many parties and friendly get-togethers leave us so sad and empty? Maybe even there, the deep-seated and often unconscious competition between people prevents them from revealing themselves to each other and from establishing relationships that last longer than the party itself. Very often we will leave the party more aware of our loneliness than we did when we came in. Of course, the language that we use in our social occasions would suggest anything but loneliness. We say things like, "Please come in, so good to see you. Let me introduce you to some great people who you're going to love meeting." And we might leave saying how good it was to see you, and "We must get together again sometime soon. It was great to hear all you had to say, and I wish I could hear more people say things like that." Nouwen suggests that it is a language which reveals the desire to be close and receptive, but in reality fails to bridge those gaps between us and to heal the root of our loneliness. The roots of loneliness and isolation are in fact very deep and cannot be touched simply by optimistic advertisements or social togetherness. Loneliness has its sustenance in the suspicion that people don't really care for us, and people certainly don't offer love without conditions, and that there's no place where we really can be vulnerable without being exploited or used. And the many small rejections that we experience every day, whether it be a sarcastic smile or a flippant remark, a brisk denial or a bitter silence, even though they may all be quite innocent and hardly worth our attention, and yet they constantly arouse our basic human fear of being left totally alone. And so we will do everything possible to avoid that experience of being alone, and we create the most ingenious devices to prevent ourselves from being reminded of our condition. Our culture has become most sophisticated in the avoidance of this pain. We create for ourselves a state of anesthesia. But we panic when there is nothing or nobody left to distract us, when there's no project left to finish, no friend to visit, no book to read, no television to watch, no music to play. when we're left all alone by ourselves, we are brought so close to the revelation of our basic human aloneness and are so afraid of the all-experiencing and all-pervasive sense of loneliness that we will do anything to get busy again and to continue the game which makes us believe that everything's fine after all. But this state of anesthesia, this craving for superficiality to cover up our pain, means that our ability to relate to other people with any depth is sorely limited. Henry David Thoreau writes, "When our life ceases to be inward and private, conversation degenerates into mere gossip. We rarely meet a person who can tell us any news which he has not simply read in a newspaper or been told by his neighbour. The only difference between us is what one of us has read and what another hasn't. And so we desperately fill our minds and lives with trivia." Newman suggests that the first task of any school should be to protect its privilege of offering free time. The Latin word schola means free time, time to understand ourselves and our world. And it's a really hard struggle to keep free time truly free and to prevent education from degenerating into just another form of competition and rivalry. The problem, however, is that we not only want our freedom, but we also fear it. And it is this fear which makes us so intolerant towards our own loneliness and makes us grab prematurely for some kind of solution. Our loneliness drives us too quickly into the company of others, so that we enter into those relationships with a deep longing and craving for our loneliness to be satisfied. But no friend or partner or community will be able to put to rest our deep craving for unity and wholeness. And by burdening others with these divine expectations, of which we ourselves are only partially aware, we might inhibit the expression of genuine friendship and love and instead evoke feelings of inadequacy and weakness. Friendship and love cannot develop in the form of an anxious clinging to each other. They ask for gentle, fearless space in which we can move to and from each other. As long as our loneliness brings us together with the hope that we together will no longer be alone, we castigate each other with our unfulfilled and unrealistic desires for oneness, for peace, and for uninterrupted experiences of community. We should wonder if the many conflicts and quarrels, the many accusations and recriminations, the many moments of expressed and repressed anger and of confessed or unconfessed jealousies, which are so often part of these rushed into relationships, do not find their roots in the false claim that the one has to take away the other's loneliness. We are sometimes tempted to believe that our lack of that our feeling of loneliness and sadness are actually a sign of lack of mutual openness. Perhaps sometimes this is true, but real openness to each other also means a real closeness, because only they who can hold a secret can safely share knowledge. And when we do not protect with great care our own inner mystery, we will never be able to form community. It is this inner mystery that attracts us to each other and allows us to establish friendships and develop lasting relationships of love. An intimate relationship between people not only asks for mutual openness, but also for mutual respectful protection of each other's uniqueness. Our world is full of empty chatter, easy confessions, hollow talk, senseless compliments, poor praise, and boring confidentialities. We are presented in newspapers and magazines with the most boring trivialities and supercilious idiosyncrasies of people whose lives are already flattened out by morbid exhibitionism. It's ironic that we live in a period of history when we have become acutely aware of our alienation from one another, and so we've assumed that the solution is to be found in human togetherness, and it's easy to see how many relationships and marriages are suffering from this illusion. Often they started out with the hope of a union that can dispel the painful feelings of not belonging and continue the desperate struggle to reach harmony. And many people find it very hard to appreciate a certain closeness in relationships. They do not know how to create the boundaries that allow intimacy to become something that's always new and a surprising discovery of each other. These words by Gahil Gibran are often quoted at weddings. He says, "Sing and dance together and be joyous, but let each one of you be alone, even as the strings of a lute are alone. though they quiver with the same music. Stand together, yet not too near together. For the pillars of the temple stand apart, and the oak tree and the cypress grow not in each other's shadow. So what then do we do with our essential aloneness, which so often breaks into our consciousness as the experience of a desperate sense of loneliness? What does it mean to say that neither friendship nor love, neither marriage nor community can take that loneliness away? These are hard questions because they come out of our wounded hearts, but they have to be listened to, even when they lead to a difficult road. And this difficult road is the road of a conversion from loneliness to solitude. Instead of running away from our loneliness and trying to forget or deny it, we have to protect it and turn it into fruitful solitude. To live a spiritual life, we must first find the courage to enter into the desert of our loneliness and to change it by gentle and persistent efforts into a garden of solitude. This requires not only courage, but also faith, as hard as it is to believe that the dry, desolate desert can yield endless varieties of flowers, it's equally hard to imagine that our loneliness is hiding unknown beauty. The movement from loneliness to solitude, however, is the beginning of a spiritual life because it is the movement from the restless sense to the restful spirit, so that we no longer have to live in a frenzy of activity, overwhelmed and afraid of every missed opportunity. If we can stop clinging to people and books and events and experiences and projects and plans, secretly hoping that this time it will solve the problem. When we finally listen to our restless hearts, we might start to sense that in the midst of our sadness, there is joy. That in the midst of our fears, there is peace. And in the midst of our greediness, there is the possibility of compassion. And that indeed, in the midst of our irking loneliness, we can find the beginnings of a quiet solitude.